concerning morals if you don't bring up the scriptures with which the pagan society totally dismisses as irrelevant.
Well, I think they're, you know, kind of behind the words of scripture are transcendent moral truths that are built into the created order, the created world. And I mean, the importance of marriage and love and the sacredness of human life. And the challenge is communicating those truths to the public in ways that the public can accept.
But many within the public will argue you're just not open-minded. You're closed-minded. You're prudish. You're Victorian. You just want to take us back. We want to move forward. In fact, the whole vision of the Obama administration is don't get us involved in these Tea Party things. You're always looking back. We want to look forward and create a new world.
Well, there are a whole bunch of myths bound up in all those cliches. But for example, I think it's important for us at this time and stage of our country to bring out to the public the medical risks to women from abortion. That it's bad for women and for the unborn child. It's not good. Abortion is not good for the child, obviously, and it's not good for women either.
Aren't those pragmatic arguments? Those are not arguments of principle. They're arguments of pragmatism. What works? What's good?
Well, no, actually, I think that they are a kind of a natural law argument, that if you violate the natural law, there will be consequences. And the negative consequences of abortion, the increased risk of preterm birth and future pregnancies, for example, are the natural consequences of violating the natural law. And we should expect there to be natural negative consequences mm-hmm. of violating God's law.
Exactly. Again, you called it God's law, and therein lies one of our big problems and takes us back even to the thinking of the French Revolution, where the call was liberty, equality, and fraternity, with a rebellion against all authority and especially against God and God's law, elevating the God of reason over the God of righteousness. And I think that brings us to this incredible time that we live in on the near edge of the Second Coming, where we're faced with an ever-increasing rebellion against God's law, whether in the Scriptures or as written in nature, and we're giving ourselves over to a reprobate mind. And in the midst of that, men like you in your arena, and all of us in our respective places must persist to live out the call of righteousness and to do our very best to call the people to a goodly and godly standard. And that will, by definition, be for the common good, won't it?
Yes, we must persevere against all those obstacles that you've mentioned, and accept those as the realities around us, and yet persevere to identify solutions to those problems, and to persevere for the greatest good possible in our time.
Well, I think you've helped to give a very good perspective in your book, Politics for the Greatest Good, The Case for Prudence in the Public Square, and I commend you for your work. I want to make sure that our listeners make every opportunity to get a copy of it. Your gift of $23 or more to Save America Ministries will put this very unusual work in your hands. Call us, 1-800-SAVE-USA, and I want to urge you to become a partner with us, because day after day we're preparing the way of the Lord for history's final hour, and also confronting the issues that touch our hearts and our homes from God's eternal perspective. So become a partner. Don't wait for the other guy to do it. You become a partner. Shoulder the plow with us and send your gifts by faith to Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia 23255. God bless you. Be a blessing. And let's get out there into the public arena and be a blessing.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Chrismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners.
Oh, beautiful for spacious skies. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming into the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But as a battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Don Scott, who's a Canadian, who has some amazing information on a number of the new diseases that are plaguing the American and Canadian people. Now, Sydney, you're not going to hear about these diseases. You're not going to hear about their origin. You're going to get what the media tells you. Just as today, the 40th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King, there's probably not more than 1 in 10,000 Americans who know that the King family brought a civil lawsuit against Lloyd Jowers for the part that he played in the murder of Martin Luther King, that a jury trial was held in the United States, that the jury held that the U.S. government was involved in the murder of Martin Luther King, that Lloyd Jowers had confessed the part that he was actually paid to assist in the murder of Martin Luther King, that the federal government sent an innocent man, James Earl Ray, to prison, where he eventually died. How could you suppress something of that sort in America? Why, we have freedom of the press. Those who own the press have the freedom to suppress whatever they want to. If you would like the story of Martin Luther King, we're putting together a four-tape set. You can order it now and certainly get it as soon as it's completed, probably in a few weeks, or you can wait and order it then. But you need to know about the trial that was held and how that information was suppressed, because, of course, they could not let the American people know of the complicity of high government officials and our intelligence agencies and the murder of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, certainly of Bobby Kennedy, who incidentally was shot from behind, whereas Saran Saran was standing in front, and then, of course, of Martin Luther King. It's all covered in a number of books we carry. One of them, The Elite Serial Killers. The Elite Serial Killers. But we'll have a wonderful four-tape set on the death of Martin Luther King very, very shortly. Well, with that as a background, let's get to our special guest this evening, Don Scott. Don, thank you so very much for being with us. It's late. I know it's getting late up there in Canada.
Yes, it's 11 o'clock at night, and but it's always a pleasure to chat with you about these issues that you constantly placed before the public, and thank you for the opportunity again.
And thank you for the book. I got the new book that you've written. I've read the first part of it. I'm probably 40 or 50 pages into it. It's a 500-page book, but it's got
actually 660 pages, Dr. Stan.
Tremendous amount of information, and of course, it's so difficult for the average American to believe that there could have been government complicity in the creation of this terrible, deadly disease. And yet, of course, although it took me a long time to become aware of that and really to be willing to accept that that is possible, that anybody could be that crass, that anybody could be that cruel, that anybody could be that indifferent to human suffering and death, I'm firmly convinced of the government complicity. And we don't know what part of the government, although there's a lot of evidence to suggest there's work through the military, through the CIA, at the highest levels of our government, and everything has been done to conceal that information, because, of course, they could not let the American people understand that the government was involved in creating a disease that has killed countless millions of people throughout the world, and certainly well over 600,000 Americans. And, of course, it will continue and continue and continue, because there is no effective treatment or cure for this disease they've created. And that's exactly what they intended. But it wasn't just AIDS. It was chronic fatigue. It was fibromyalgia. It was certainly other disease. We'll be back in just a moment with Don Scott. Well, Don, you just go right ahead and pick the story up.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Stan, and as you indicated, it's not just AIDS, but our book, age, The Crime Beyond Belief, focuses upon AIDS because it is a eugenics program. It is a program that was designed to reduce the population of the black people of the world. And this is done scientifically. This isn't something that happens because of lifestyle or nutrition or something along that line. And in our book, AIDS, The Crime Beyond Belief, we don't try to simply make a statement and then leave it for people to believe or not believe. We try to point out the scientific and medical evidence that was available to the National Institutes of Health and the Centers for Disease Control, and especially when these so-called health-focused agencies of government were cooperating with the Department of Defense in the creation of biological weapons, and the biological weapons aimed at black people in particular when it respect to AIDS. Now, as an example of how we focused to the best of our ability on the science and medicine of AIDS as a eugenics agent, we have on page 538 of our book an item from 1953. Now, this is a summary of an article which appeared in a medical journal way back in 1953. And the medical journal was a very specialized journal that practically no ordinary citizen of the world would read, but it's one of the many journals that we studied in our study of their development of the AIDS cofactors. And the article is by Dr. Maurice Shepherd, a Ph.D., and it appeared in the American Journal of Syphilis, Gonorrhea, and Venereal Diseases, volume 38, pages 113 to 124. Now, this is a very obscure journal to the average person, and it is a very obscure subject to the average person.
Don, hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Don is certainly talking about the fact that the AIDS disease, and it is not caused, as you have been told, or most doctors believe, by simply a virus, by the HIV virus. It's much more complicated than that. But, of course, Don's statement, which will offend many people, is the fact that this disease is designed to target the blacks. Now, that's exactly what the Reverend Wright, who, of course, was the minister for Barack Obama, had said. Now, of course, just because he said it doesn't mean it isn't true. He is a black racist. I have no sympathy for him. But there are many black people who feel this disease was created to target the blacks. And if you want evidence of that for yourself, look at the AIDS statistics today. Almost half, or perhaps over half, of the AIDS cases in the United States are in the black population. That makes up only 13% of the nation's population. How could that have happened just by accident? You'd say, oh, well, they're much more promiscuous than anybody else. Do you honestly believe that? I mean, certainly if you go into Botswana today, and you... we actually do the figures there. The U.S. Census Bureau goes into Botswana and regularly tests the people there. 46% of the pregnant women in Botswana are HIV infected. They're all going to die. How could that have possibly happened? That is either the greatest public health tragedy of all time or the most successful genocidal policy. I would like to suggest it's the latter. So you pick up a story there. Don was telling us about how they had found or mentioned in a magazine published back in 1953, a rather obscure journal which most doctors, most people would never read. But what was the title of the article and who wrote it, Don?
The title was The Recovery of pleural pneumonia-like organisms from Negro men with and without non-gonococcal urethritis. And the importance of the article is that it points out that Dr. Shepherd took 100 healthy black Negro college students, and he took 100 healthy white college students, and he tested both of these groups, and they were both without urethritis, and yet the black students, healthy black students, had 56 out of the 100 black students carried naturally what they call a pleural pneumonia-like organism.
This was a mycoplasma organism.
This is a mycoplasma.
Right.
Naturally, these healthy black men carried this mycoplasma, whereas only 2 out of the white men carried the mycoplasma naturally. Now, here's the point. The evidence points out scientifically that AIDS is not a single disease agent. There is actually no such thing as an HIV virus or HI virus. There are cofactors, and one of the cofactors is a mycoplasma. Now, the mycoplasma is a particle of a bacterial DNA. Now, this is all very technical, but what it amounts to is this, that AIDS requires 2 disease agents, cofactors. One of the disease agents is the mycoplasma, and 56 out of 100 healthy black men carry this mycoplasma naturally without any signs of sickness or illness. It's part of their genetic makeup, whereas only 2 out of 100 white men carry it. Therefore, if the, as the evidence points out, AIDS is caused by cofactors, one of which is a mycoplasma, 56 out of 100 blacks already have that in their body genetically.
But I think, isn't mycoplasma that is associated with AIDS, isn't that a very specific one, the mycoplasma fermentans, not necessarily the mycoplasma pneumoniae, but certainly there there is a retrovirus very closely related to the Vizna C virus. That's what they call the HIV virus. But then what they never tell our physicians or the average American is there also is a mycoplasma infection along with that. But aren't most of that mycoplasma fermentans incognitus?
Yes, the mycoplasma fermentans. The incognitus part seems to be very hard to establish, but the mycoplasma fermentans is the agent that these black students, subject of Dr. Shepherd's testing, were infected with. Now, the important point I'd like to make here is that the mycoplasma is not only a factor in AIDS, but it is a factor in other many, many, many other diseases, including cancer. Now, you can take the latest book that approaches the bestseller category in respect to cancers, and that is a book by Dr. Deborah Davis of Pittsburgh, and it's called The History of the Secret War on Cancer. And Dr. Davis points out in that Secret History of the War on Cancer that a significant, very, very significant number of blacks get cancers more than whites do. On almost every 20th or 30th page of her very scientific book, mixed in with exciting and important anecdotes, she has references to blacks being infected with certain cancers against the whites, who are 30% less infected than the blacks are. Now, why do blacks have more AIDS than whites, and why do blacks have more cancers than whites? Well, they found out in their scientific research, including the research of Dr. Shepherd, that blacks naturally carry the mycoplasma in their makeup. And there are other factors contribute to this mycoplasma emerging as AIDS in some people and as cancers in others. But there is a tendency, in fact, it's a reality that there is a distinct effort in the scientific world of medicine today to downplay the mycoplasma, to pretend it does not exist. And I can give a very, very good example of that. Johns Hopkins Medical University, they produce an 1,800-page book called The Family Health Guide, and in it they claim to present in summary form all the important things you need to know about health in your family today. And in those 1,800 pages, nowhere do they mention the mycoplasma as being a disease agent that you should even know the name of, let alone know the role of.
And I think it was so interesting in your book, you pointed out that in the university they have for military officers, military medical officers, there's a whole section on mycoplasm and of course how devastating this disease is. But the average doctor doesn't know that. I know when I went to medical school, I'd never heard of it. I never heard of mycoplasma until I came back from Africa about 1980, that they began to point out that almost a quarter of all the pneumonias we had, the atypical pneumonias, were related to mycoplasma. Almost a quarter of the influenzas we have today are related to mycoplasma, but the average doctor just doesn't know that, because the people who control access to information don't want the doctors to know. So you go right ahead.
Yes, isn't it amazing that in the world of communication such as we have today, with all kinds of television shows and radio shows and special features and articles in newspapers and all the rest of it dealing with health, you won't find practically ever a reference to the mycoplasma and the fact that it plays a role not only in AIDS and chronic fatigue and lupus and so on, but even in Alzheimer's. And in our book, on page 627, we summarize for our readers the mycoplasma pneumoniae clinical manifestations of infection. Now, this is a way that this particular mycoplasma species, and there are many, 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 many more species, but this is just one of them. The mycoplasma pneumoniae can turn up in the respiratory system, according to this chart on page 627 of our book, and there's a whole list of diseases that people get from that in the respiratory system. It can turn up in their neurological system. It can turn up in their cardiac system. It can turn up in the gastrointestinal system. It can turn up in the hematological system and the muscular, skeletal, genital, urinary, and immunological system. Now, that's all on one chart in one page of our book to demonstrate that the mycoplasma is a very serious disease agent. But if you turn to the Johns Hopkins Family Health Book, 1,800 pages, you won't find it mentioned anywhere. Well, when we tried to find it and it wasn't in the Johns Hopkins Family Health Book, we phoned the editor of that health book. That's Dr. Michael J. Quagg. And he wasn't available to talk to us at the time we phoned him in August 2005. And he wasn't available a few weeks later, and he wasn't available a couple of months later than that. And then finally we got hold of his assistant, and she said, "What is it you want to talk to Dr. Craig about?" And I said, "Well, I already have left a message several times."
Hold that thought, we'll be right back. All right, go ahead. You finally got hold of the doctor's assistant there at Johns Hopkins University, trying to find out why they would put out this the very extensive book and never mention the mycoplasm. So what did the assistant tell you?
Well, with...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Well, many men begin having prostate symptoms when they get to be 60 years of age, so Radio Liberty is offering a great product. It's called Prostate Support. It's put together by one of the country's leading health food manufacturers. It contains ingredients which have been proven to work. I know health experts who take the product, and I use it as well, and I think that really is very effective. In addition, we have a product for women during that difficult time of life. It's called Menopause Support. And lastly, we have a product for people who have chronic difficulty with their immune system and nothing else seems to work. It's called Immune Support. All are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. These products are compiled by a very reliable company. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
The general public about disease and ignore the part that mycoplasm played. And of course, after calling numerous times, it's very obvious they are not going to reply, and they certainly do not want the American people to realize, or the doctors to realize. The doctors certainly are victims of this as well. And everything is done to play down the part that the mycoplasm plays in so many of the diseases that afflict their patients. But that information is censored. Why? Because, as Don points out, one of the major thrusts of American foreign and domestic policy is population control, wouldn't we be far better off without so many elderly people? Then the Medicare system would work. If we didn't have so many people, the Social Security system would work. The problem is that people are living so long, and if they were to die off much earlier, all of these grandiose utopian plans would work better. And people say nobody could be that crass and indifferent, and I would say, I used to think that way. I no longer do. Please go ahead, Don.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. And in Dr. Davis's book, nowhere in the whole book does she mention once the word mycoplasma. But not only that, Dr. Davis, in that book called The Secret History of the War on Cancer, she's playing on words that people use in society without really knowing the reality. The people don't know the reality of what's going on. She plays on it and yet does not herself tell the whole story. And yet we have reason to believe that she knows the whole story, because in our research we found, as you have found many years ago, that an important role was played by the United States government in developing the cofactors that lead to AIDS, one of them being the mycoplasma. You discovered that the Special Virus Cancer Program, which was supposed to be part of Richard Nixon's war on cancer, where Nixon, through his spokesperson, Henry Kissinger, said they were going to find the cause and cure for cancer, and they got the Congress to go along, Congress and Senate to go along, just like they got the Congress and Senate to go along with the Iraq War, with a whole lot of hocus-pocus baloney. And they created, or they said they were creating, a special virus cancer program. And in her book, Dr. Davis doesn't mention the special virus cancer program at all by name. She mentions the fact that some of her colleagues were involved in the Great War on Cancer, but she does not really, nowhere in the book does she mention the special virus cancer program. And unlike our book, where we show how the Special Virus Cancer Program did not begin in 1972 when Nixon declared war on cancer, it began way back in 1952 when President Eisenhower was elected president, and he said to Nelson Rockefeller, I want you in my cabinet, what role would you like? And Nelson Rockefeller surprised everybody who seemed to know anything about politics in those days. He said that he wanted to be Assistant Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. And what does he know about health, education, and welfare? Well, the thing is, Nelson Rockefeller was bringing into the official government agenda of the United States part of what is called the Rockefeller apparatus agenda. And a significant part of that agenda was genetics, the eugenic reduction of population growth. And this was a great campaign of the Rockefellers and their colleagues, the Morgans and the Harrimans and others, for many years. But in 1952, Nelson Rockefeller was able to get an appointment as Assistant Secretary of especially Health. And what did he do? Well, according to the book called The Rockefellers by Collier and Horowitz, and this isn't Dr. Leonard Horowitz, by the way, this is another Horowitz, but in that very, very important biography of the Rockefellers, the Horowitz and Collier point out that Nelson Rockefeller, when he went into the National Institutes for Health as Assistant Secretary...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment there. Bye-bye. Okay, this is Dr. Stan. I guess Don Scott and you was just talking about, of course, the book, The Rockefellers by Collier and Horowitz. And after Nelson Rockefeller became the Assistant Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, that would have been 1953, what did he do?
He created what he called a war room. And he did not share what he was doing with his fellow colleagues in health, education, welfare. He brought in many, many, many people from the Rockefeller apparatus, and in secret they began cooperating with the Department of Defense. Now, he's supposed to be concerned with health, but he began working with the Department of Defense. And the evidence that emerges is they established programs where their intent was to develop the mycoplasma as a disease agent because it had been learned by the scientists of that time that the mycoplasma was an excellent agent to have involved in biological warfare because it put down the human immune system.
In other words, the mycoplasma suppresses the immune system, and it is by suppressing the immune system, of course, that people get cancer and so many other diseases. If they can't fight off the diseases, they succumb to them. So go right ahead.
Yes, so here is Nelson Rockefeller with the Rockefeller agenda working in the government of the United States, and they established under the CIA, which was also newly created just before Eisenhower was elected, was created by President Truman. Under Eisenhower and Rockefeller and Allen Dulles, it was greatly extended. They created a special program called MK Ultra. Now, the MK, we know, stands for monkey kidneys. And ULTRA, we know from official government documents, stands for umbrella. So a monkey kidney aid program with umbrella quality, it means a whole lot of things could go on under it. They established the MK ULTRA as the umbrella organization. And under MK ULTRA, they established the MK Delta program and the MK Naomi program, and these were CIA programs where they were attempting to take the mycoplasma. Now, we have all the evidence.
Hold that thought, Tom. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Don was simply pointing out that, of course, when Nelson Rockefeller became the Assistant Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, he brought in many people from the Rockefeller organizations, foundations, and others. Their goal, population control. They established a relationship with the Department of the Army. They began to develop the mycoplasma. Why? Because mycoplasma is an excellent biological warfare agent because it suppresses the immune system and, of course, predisposes people to disease and to cancer. Why would anybody do that? Because there are people who are dedicated to population control. And that became the major theme of the Nixon administration. And when in 1974, they put forward the National Security Study Memorandum 200, pointing out that the major thrust of American foreign domestic policy was population control. But back in 1953, when Nelson Rockefeller was working there as a high official in the Department of Health, why, of course, they were beginning then to determine how they could use the mycoplasma as a biological warfare agent, not against the enemy, but against the American people and against people in all civilized societies, because there were just too many of them. What an effective means of destroying humanity, other than to develop a new pathogen that would destroy the immune system. So you pick up this story there, Don.
Yes, well, Rockefeller in Hugh established the war room. They established the monkey kidney ultra program, and the idea there was to take monkey kidneys and grind them up into a pulp and use them as a source of food for the mycoplasma and to breed the mycoplasma in vast, vast quantities so that they could have it to work with in their laboratories under their program, MK Ultra, and so on. Now, they wanted to develop the mycoplasma because it, as I mentioned, is an absolutely efficient agent for the depression of the human immune system. So you can put down the immune system. It's like putting down the fence around the lion's cage in the zoo. With that fence down, the lions can get out. With the immune system down, the disease agents, such as the agents that cause cancer, and there are viral origins for cancer that we have learned about and that we are writing about and so on, can get in, and not only can the cancer virus, which sounds very sensational, but we've got the evidence and we can't go into it here, but all the other opportunistic diseases that can enter into a human body when the immune system is down, and then when you have that situation, you have AIDS. So they established a camp called Camp Lindy in the Belgian Congo, and they captured many hundreds of chimpanzees, and they brought these chimpanzees to Camp Lindy, and they raised them there, and they killed them, and they took their kidneys, and they grew the mycoplasma on it, and then they used the mycoplasma in various experiments under the guise of testing an anti-polio disease control agent. And this was under Dr. Hilary Koprowski of the Wistar Institute in the United States. But in addition to that, they established in New Orleans, under the auspices of Dr. Alton Ochsner of Tulane University, they established a program there, and they created a delta primate farm to raise rhesus monkeys. This meant a separate program under MK Ultra called MK Delta. And the MK stands for the monkey kidney. The Delta stands for the Mississippi Delta. And so actually they were working on two species of AIDS, one based upon the kidneys of chimpanzees in Belgium, Congo, and one based upon the kidneys of rhesus monkeys in Tulane University and Delta Primate Farm in Louisiana. And so we have two types of AIDS. One type of AIDS was used in vaccines against black people in Africa, where the colonies were administered by Belgians, British, and French. The other vaccine was used in Brazil, Goa, and other colonies administered by the Portuguese, and was developed by Dr. Alton Ochsner of Tulane University. So the United States government, under the aegis of Nelson Rockefeller, took a disease agent, made it into a biological agent, and spread it to the target populations that they especially had in mind, and AIDS was on its way under various kinds of CIA code names. But when it was just nicely getting going and Eisenhower's term expired, 8 years was up, they fully expected that his vice president, Richard Nixon, would succeed him and he would carry on with the program. But he was defeated by John F. Kennedy, who was very much anti-population control. He wanted the world's population to be modified, but he wanted it to be modified by individual efforts to limit family size without the government coming in with secret programs. So essentially, the programs that had been developed under Eisenhower and Nelson Rockefeller and the CIA went into a period of hiatus, where nothing was done for 3 years worth mentioning because they couldn't do it without Kennedy finding out about it. And it was not until he was murdered by the same agents that were developing the AIDS as a device to limit world population growth. It was only after he was killed, and he was succeeded by a person, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who I must say to the people of the United States was a gangster. William Baines Johnson brought the program back out in full swing when he succeeded Mr. Kennedy as President of the United States. And you can find this in Johnson's own biography, a book he called Vantage Point. And in that book, Vantage Point, he says that when he came into the presidency, succeeding Mr. Kennedy, he found that only $6 million a year was being used on population control programs, and that by the time he left, he said, that was up to $115 million a year. Look at the number of times it was doubled to go from $6 million to $115 million. And Johnson established a population control council with the John Rockefeller III and William Cohen as co-chairman, and they were back in business to create the biological agents for the limitation of population growth. Then, of course, Mr. Johnson was succeeded by Nixon, and Nixon appointed Henry Kissinger as his national security advisor, and Henry Kissinger was then able to take the whole, all these programs that had first existed as CIA programs and then had been moved out of the CIA basement by Johnson, he was able to put them front and center with a special virus cancer program, and they got into the full-time business then, not so much of finding out how to create AIDS, but how to get it spread, because they had already found this out when the work of Dr. Huebner and others told them how dangerous the mycoplasma was. And this is where Johns Hopkins comes in. Johns Hopkins and many, many other apparently reputable, believable institutions of great public trust were actually betraying the public trust. Now, we have a good example of that in Canada as well. We have a university here in Canada called Queen's University in Kingston. During this period of time, at Queen's University, they were receiving every month from what we call the Dominion Parasite Laboratory in Belleville, Ontario, Canada, 100 million mosquitoes a month. Now, the government of Canada was breeding 100 million mosquitoes a month. Now, can you or your listeners picture a government breeding mosquitoes and doing this secretly and transferring this, the mosquitoes every month to the Queen's University, and Queen's University then contaminates them with various disease agents, and they won't say what the disease agents were, but we are very, very convinced that it was among them was the mycoplasma. Queen's University contaminates these mosquitoes, then they give them to the Canadian military, and the Canadian military shares them with the United States military. So you now have in the hands of the U.S. military, the Canadian military, the British military, agents of population control, which present that, among other things, as AIDS and as chronic fatigue syndrome. Now, I made this statement showing all of our sources down at a meeting near Kingston, Ontario, a few years ago. And I showed all the documents. We've got the documents. My goodness, there's no lack of documents. There's just a lack of publication of those in the mainline media. And I demonstrated the Queen's University's complicity in creating these disease agents. And the newspaper reporter for the Brockville Times, he was at the meeting, and he was kind of one of these smart-alecky guys that Don Scott is a conspiracy theorist. He ignored all the scientific documents I had, including Dr. Shepard's 1953 paper and so on. And he got in touch with Queen's University. And the dean of the medicine at Queen's University said, well, that's not true at all. And it was true, believe me. And he says, if Don Scott says this again, Queen's University will sue him. Wonderful news. Wonderful news. I was looking so much forward to being sued in a court of law by Queen's University to present my evidence about how Queen's University had cooperated with the Dominion Parasite Laboratory and with the United States military in creating mycoplasma-infected mosquitoes. And although they said they would sue me if I said it again, I sent them a notice telling them I was going to say it again at a meeting, and they were invited to be there with cameras and recording devices and get it all on tape for their suit. They never turned up. And I'll try to keep them pretty well notified whenever I get a chance that I'm saying it again and again and again. That AIDS and other diseases that have a mycoplasmal component were largely responsible, is largely the responsibility of the United States government. And as you mentioned in the interlude of this program, Pastor Wright was absolutely correct when he said that AIDS was developed by the CIA to decimate the black population.
It is decimating the black population in the United States, as I mentioned earlier.
Yes,
almost half
States.
Of the cases in the United States are in blacks. And you go into Africa, it's decimating the population there because it's made to targeted for blacks. When you understand that, you can understand why many blacks are resentful and why aren't the whites out there trying to find out if it's really true and then demanding that the people who are guilty of these terrible crimes against humanity be held responsible. It's really men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And if you're listening to this program, I hope you'll want to check out what's being said. We'll give you the sources where you can begin to evaluate this on your own. And could it really be true? And I believe with all my heart that it is. Go right ahead, Don. Go right ahead, Don.
Dr. Stan, our book, which we sent you a copy of and you have been looking at and reading, AIDS, a crime beyond belief, we tried to bring together the medical evidence, the scientific evidence, the historical evidence, the political evidence, and military evidence, and so on, all in one book, which demonstrates that AIDS and chronic fatigue, new diseases brought into the world through the agency of the mycoplasma and the cofactors, plus the burgeoning numbers of cancer cases in Canada, United States, and the world, and the role of the mycoplasma in those diseases as well, and how books such as that by Dr. Deborah Davis, The Secret History of the War on Cancer, mislead the public about many, many aspects of the programs, and we count on people like yourself and your program to share with the listeners who are alert to what they're really hearing. AIDS and the related diseases are the product of American government scientific manipulation for purposes of limiting population growth rate.
And of course, most of the people who work for the government have no ideas about this. Most of this is related to the Defense Department or, of course, to the CIA, that special contingent of the CIA that is involved in truly evil and dark activities. So our guest, of course, is Don Scott. You'll go right ahead, Don.
Well, Dr. Stan, I'm sorry, you faded out almost totally there, and I didn't hear that last statement.
Oh, I just said that certainly there are lots of people working in the government who have no idea what this is about, but there is an element within our military, there is an element within the CIA, who are sworn to secrecy. If they were to reveal what they know, they'd be sent to prison for the rest of their lives or killed. They cannot allow the American people to really realize what's going on. I mean, after all, could you imagine if it came out that AIDS was actually created laboratory, that they spent millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars to develop this terrible new disease, and the chronic fatigue disease that affects probably well over a million Americans, and the fibromyalgia that affects 2 million Americans, and the Lyme disease that incapacitates another million Americans, that these were actually created in laboratories to disable and destroy human lives? Well, Don, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Stan. I appreciate the opportunity of sharing with you and with your listeners the realities of the mycoplasma as a disease.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about any unexpected crisis. Freeze-dried guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze-dry guy, the best you can buy.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com.
Issue, you'll know that it's absolutely true, and we'll give you the documentation on that in subsequent interviews. I have no sympathy at all for Reverend White. He's a black racist, and there's no room for racism among honorable people today. He's doing everything he can, of course, to destroy our country. He has no love for America, and he is a very dangerous man. But just because some of the things he said were absolutely right, that doesn't mean that, or just because some of the things he said, you have to recognize they may well be right, but of course they're trying to destroy them and these ideas because you're supposed to hate Reverend Wright. Do not hate him. Pity anybody who has so much hatred in him. Now, if you're interested in getting Don Scott's book, you can give us a call. We'll let you know when we know what it will come to. But you really would want to get my material, my talk on Nundare, call it genocide. It goes into population control. My talk on planned population reduction. My talk on population control, which is available on video, will soon be available on DVD. We've written a treatise. You can find it on our website of RadioLiberty.com. It's called The Population Control Agenda Monograph. The Population Control Agenda Monograph. Go to RadioLiberty.com. RadioLiberty.com. You can pull it down, or if you would prefer and you get into the other items, you can simply ask for a copy of the Population Control Agenda Monograph, and we'll send it to you free of charge if you get some of the other items. We have a four-tape set or a four-CD set on population control. You must understand that the reason that DDT was outlawed was not because it was harmful. It was humanity, or was killing all the fishes. It was just an effective means of saving human lives. And since, of course, we've discontinued the use of DDT, why, we've killed almost 100 million people. Since we discontinued using DDT, we've killed almost 100 million African people. And if you hate Africans, why, of course, you'd support that decision to outlaw DDT. It's interesting that now the World Health Organization has said, gee, maybe it really isn't as dangerous as we thought it was, and now we're going to start using it to spray rooms. Why, we can save millions of lives every year. Now, of course, there's another lie they tell you, that malaria only kills 1 million people a year. It kills about 3 million people a year, predominantly black. You can verify this on the Internet. Just go up on Google and Google malaria kills, 3 million people a year. You'll find out that what they're telling you in the controlled media in the United States just isn't true. And once you begin to understand that, of course, so many things begin to make sense. The media is controlled in the United States. The book, of course, is The New Media Monopoly by Ben Bekdakian, Professor Bekdakian, who points out that five mega corporations control the media, and they express freedom of the press. They own the press. They have the freedom to suppress whatever they want to. And the last thing they want you to know is that the HIV virus was genetically modified, that mycoplasm plays a part in this. There are two books we carry. One is called Emerging Viruses. Emerging Viruses, excellent book on this subject. It's what actually convinced me. The other is called Project Daylily, written by Garth Nicholson. And, of course, he was one of the most outstanding scientists in America, is even to this very day, with over 600 peer-reviewed articles. And if you read his book, you'll find out, of course, that the part that mycoplasm plays in the AIDS epidemic. He has personally told me he had met one person who was involved in the process of actually developing this new disease. There's a book called Full Disclosure, or Final Disclosure, Full Disclosure, I think it is, which, of course, we quote in our material, where, of course, one of the people who was involved in developing the disease, AIDS, was dying of cancer and came forward and told the truth. You will never hear this controlled mentioned by the controlled media. The last thing they want you to know is that this is a created disease. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring and I need to be mindful of the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and for the next hour, the views of William Grigg. Hi, William. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Dr. Stan. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing just fine. Well, what are we going to be talking about tonight?
I suspect that we're going to be discussing what everybody else is going to be talking about for quite a while in the foreseeable future, and that's what's going on with this new grandiose, liberty-destroying healthcare push that took place. I mean, this is the largest entitlement program in the history of the known universe. And the thing that I find really interesting is that just in the last 24 hours, the news media have reported something that should have been reported last week, but of course was embargoed, I suspect, for the purposes of political convenience here. That is that the Social Security program, which is sort of the grand progenitor of the American welfare state, is now financially crippled, which is to say it's paying out more than it's taking in this year. This is supposed to happen 6 years down the road, owing to the demographic curve and the predictable consequences of the way that entitlement program was structured. Within 6 years, it was supposed to be paying out more than it takes in. But owing to what's going on with the financial and economic contraction, the fact that revenues are down for Social Security, there are fewer people who are working, and hence the amount of revenue confiscated through Social Security taxes is down dramatically, this is going to create a feedback loop where you're going to have greater and greater demands made on an ever-shrinking revenue stream. And within the next decade or so, it seems to me, Social Security is going to be unambiguously broken, completely non-viable. This is the sort of thing that should have been discussed a week or two ago. No doubt the administration knew this. No doubt the actuary, Mr. Goss, who made that announcement a couple of days ago, was in possession of the relevant facts a week or so ago, or 2 weeks ago. But this is the sort of thing that wasn't permitted to pollute the debate from the perspective, of course, of the establishment here. This would have been polluting the debate over enhancing the socialist entitlement state in an unprecedented way by signing on to nationalized health care last week.
But I think really what we have to understand is, first of all, that, of course, the baby boomers are beginning to retire. Mm-hmm. Basically, we're talking about 75 million baby boomers, and they're going to be entitled to Social Security, and there's no money there. They've already spent all the
exactly.
trust fund. But the same thing is true with Medicare, and what everybody has really missed about Medicare, Medicare is not about expanding health care coverage. Medicare is about, the Obama health care program is about remaking Medicare and
yep.
rationing access and cutting back on Medicare. They cannot tell the American people that Medicare was a Ponzi scheme. They cannot tell the American people that the real purpose was not to expand health care to the uninsured. This was all about rationing health care to the elderly and letting those who are a certain age simply die, cutting off access to health care for those who reach a certain age. That's what it was really all about, but they cannot tell the American people. So they got to focus our attention on entitlements and socialism and communism without telling us the truth, and that is Obamacare is rationing access to Medicare because the system is broke. And it'll be a lot worse 2 or 3 years from now as millions more baby boomers retire. So this is, and the Social Security and Medicare, two of these, simply the pillars of our socialist entitlement system, are bankrupt, and nobody wants to tell the American people, socialism doesn't work, ladies and gentlemen. Socialism's a failure. So why are we persisting? Go right ahead, William.
You're exactly right. We're dealing with what is going to be the metastasizing failure of these entitlement programs, and they all have their origins, all these cascading failures have their origins in the same fiscal and demographic realities here. And this is something that was predicted decades ago, and it's a product of simple arithmetic that Social Security, which is a Ponzi scheme, a pyramid scheme, it's something that really is not that different from what Bernie Madoff did the Social Security was going to become non-viable within the first couple of decades of the 21st century. The baby boomer generation, I believe, started to collect Social Security about a year ago in 2009. And that cohort is the largest demographic cohort in the history of the United States. And you have basically an inverted pyramid now in terms of the way that the revenues would support this expanded number of recipients. Even if we had a healthy economy, it would not be viable. And this in large measure has to do with the fact that Social Security does not exist in a trust fund. Everybody perpetuates this fiction of a trust fund. In the story from the New York Times yesterday, Mr. Goss, the actuary for the Social Security Administration, actually said, and I'm assuming that he maintained a straight face as he propounded this lie, that the trust fund would have sufficient revenues to keep dealing out the benefits and payments irrespective of what's going on with the revenue stream, and that the system would be financially viable until 2037, which is an utterly demented fantasy. There is no trust fund. The money that is stolen from your paychecks or that is extorted from you at gunpoint in the name of Social Security goes into general revenue. And general revenue right now, of course, is badly in the shadow, the overhang of the commitments of the government. The deficits are growing. When we're talking about deficits on an annual basis in the $1 trillion or trillions of dollar range, you're obviously dealing with a situation here where general revenues are not going to be in any way sufficient to maintain the fiscal health of the federal government. And of course, we're going to be dealing with interest rates as well. Huge interest rate spikes are going to be part of the near future because it's entirely likely. And once again, this last week we felt premonitory tremblers of this forthcoming development, which is a reduction in the credit rating of the United States government from AAA status to something else. If there is a diminution in the credit rating of the federal government, the result will be this huge interest rate spike. The federal government's going to pay even more for borrowing money in order to maintain its operations. And what's going into the fund here in the name of Social Security is going to be going to pay interest rates on the accumulating debts. And that, of course, is even before we saw this so-called Obamacare.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Chris Woodham is simply pointing out that there isn't any money in the Medicare Trust Fund. There isn't any money in the Social Security Trust Fund. There are IOUs. That those IOUs are sitting in the file, and it says, you know, the trust fund has this money. It's in the form of an IOU, and it is available when you want it. But the trouble is, when you get the IOUs, why, of course, then the government has to come up with the money. But the government doesn't have any money. So they present the IOUs to the Treasury, and the Treasury, of course, has to go out and borrow the money. And that's part of the $4 to $5 billion we're having to borrow every single day to meet our expenses. This is why they had to get the health care bill through. Why? Because they cannot tell the American people that Medicare is bankrupt. They cannot tell the American people that Social Security is bankrupt, and basically they're working on an alternative to Social Security where they're going to actually have to increase taxes, which are already about 12.5% a year, and they're going to have to cut benefits. This is what they're talking about. They're going to have to cut Social Security benefits just as they're going to have to cut Medicare benefits, but nobody but William Grigg is talking about that. You go right ahead, William.
Yeah, exactly right. If you're talking about these entitlements here in terms of what is going to have to happen in order to maintain the program in the existing fiscal environment, there are going to have to be reductions in benefits and reductions in payouts. And the entire logic of what happened last week dictates that the public has to be convinced that there is not going to be forced, I don't want to use the word austerity because it doesn't apply, but forced rationing of benefits. And there's going to have to be rationing of Social Security benefits and Medicare benefits even without what happened last week. But last week, as you point out, there was a forced draft reconfiguration of the way that benefits are going to be delivered through Medicare, and there's an effort to cattle pen just about everybody in the United States into a government-run system that will exist in an increasingly straitened fiscal environment that will require withdrawal and reductions of benefits. And in a word, that means rationing. It's important to recognize, not many people want to talk about this element of it, but it's important to recognize this pretty much unavoidable reality, that in the economic realm, the only thing that government does is rationing. Government does not create wealth. Government redistributes or reassigns wealth, and it always starts from a premise of scarcity, owing to the fact that government cannot create wealth. Wealth is the creation of free productive people in the private realm. Government has to extort, confiscate, steal, appropriate, or otherwise take control of the product of other people's exertions. And so it starts from the premise of scarcity, because people only surrender to government what they legitimately earn through force or the threat thereof. And so what it does is it assigns, reallocates these forms of wealth on the basis of political calculations, and that, of course, is rationing. Now, if you're talking about a situation of legitimate scarcity, for instance, you've got people aboard the proverbial lifeboat, and they have to ration their fresh drinking water, that's, of course, something that represents an emergency situation, and somebody ends up, by force, claiming the right to allocate water. That's how things work in an environment of scarcity. During, for instance, the aftermath of Katrina and the collapse of the levee system in New Orleans, there were types of rationing that occurred where people were in conditions of scarcity. And, of course, anybody who's gone on a long trip and you simply have to make do with what's in the canteens or what's in the icebox will understand how scarcity operates. The thing is, government always operates that way. Government does not have an endless supply of resources or wealth to command. And any time government intervenes in a given market, it creates scarcity. It dislocates the market. It interrupts the market signals to help reconcile supply with demand, and you always end up with scarcity. And in the case of what's going on in the healthcare system, in the very near future, we're going to have a scarcity of the most important element of the healthcare system, and that is physicians. There is a poll that was conducted by the Medicus firm just a couple of weeks before Obamacare was rammed through, that found the following thing. I'm reading now from the Medicus firm's report on its survey. What if nearly half of all physicians in America stop practicing medicine? While a sudden loss of half of the nation's physicians seems unlikely, a very dramatic decrease in the physician workforce could become a reality as an unexpected side effect of health reform. By the way, it's unexpected to them, but it's perfectly predictable to anybody who understands how human action works in the economic realm. Medicus firm, a national physician search firm based in Dallas and Atlanta, conducted a survey of over 1,000 physicians to determine their expectations as to the impact of health reform on their practices, income, job satisfaction, and future career plans. In discussing career plans as part of the recruitment process, physicians have increasingly expressed apprehension and uncertainty regarding health reform's impact on their practices, and the Medicus firm wished to investigate this trend further. Additionally, the firm wanted to determine how doctors anticipate health reform to affect physician supply and the quality of medical care nationwide, as these are issues that will directly influence the physician recruiting industry. These factors are in addition to health reform's more obvious impact on patients and providers of health care services. The results from the Medicus firm survey entitled Physician Survey, Health Reform's Impact on Physician Supply and Quality of Medical Care, were intriguing. The BLS predicts particularly in light of the most recently published career projections from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, or BLS. BLS predicts a more than 22% increase in physician jobs during the 10-year period ending in 2018. This places physician careers in the top 20 fastest-growing occupations from 2008 to 2018. Meanwhile, nearly one-third of the physicians responding to the survey indicated that they will want to leave medical practice after health reform is implemented. What many people may not realize is that health reform could impact physician supply in such a way that the quality of medical care could suffer, said Steve Marsh, managing partner at the Medicus firm in Dallas. The reality is that there may not be enough doctors to provide quality medical care to the millions of newly insured patients. It's probably not likely that nearly half of the nation's physicians will suddenly quit practicing at once. However, even if a much smaller percentage, such as 10, 15, or 20%, are pushed out of the practice over several years at a time when the field needs to expand by over 20%, this would be severely detrimental to the quality of the healthcare system. Based on the survey results, health reform could, over time, prove to be counterproductive in that it would decrease patients' access to medical care, while the objective is to increase access. Now, that's a perfectly predictable result, once again, of the nationalization and the politicization of what remains, and there's very little of it extant, of physician-centered, relatively free market health care in this country. Anytime the government intervenes, it creates a dislocation. In this case, it's going to create a shortage of doctors. There will be a surfeit of subsidies in the system. This is something that Nancy Pelosi mentioned in the immediate afterglow of this gang rape that was inflicted upon the American public by Congress and the Obama administration. She was saying, literally minutes after Obama affixed his signature to that bill, that health companies had to make sure that they behaved as the federal government wanted them to behave, or else they wouldn't have access to these new insurance exchanges, where they wouldn't be able to receive access to all these subsidized patients, these subsidized so-called customers that are going to be forced into this system. And she was simply speaking the language of central planning. Now that we have the power, we're going to require you to behave the way that we dictate, and if you don't, then you're not going to have access to this economy. She was talking that way with the insurers, and the insurers actually make out pretty well in this new system, because you've got, once again, the idea that the federal government is going to be pumping money in to subsidize purchase and to mandate, literally the point of the gun, mandate that people purchase this insurance, so that it's a pretty good deal for the insurers. But in spite of the fact that the insurers are the ones who stand to benefit from the bill, you had Pelosi talking to them this way. And, of course, this doesn't take into account the fact that the people who actually have to practice medicine aren't going to benefit from this. There's going to be a creation of an economy in which they're going to be overworked and underpaid. They're not going to be able to practice medicine according to their best judgment. They're going to have to be functionaries of these public-private, which is to say fascist, exchanges that represent pretty much an enhancement of the worst aspects of the system we have right now, where third-party payers and the veterinary ethic as applied to the treatment of human beings are very much the order of the day. By way of illustrating the problems that are attendant to this whole system, I'd cite what happened in my recent hospitalization last August and September when I faced a very serious illness. I spent a lot of time talking with my attending physicians about what was happening in the healthcare debate, and many of them related to me the frustrations they have dealing with the people who represent the managed care outfits that are involved in insuring, that is to say underwriting. Insurance is really a misnomer here when we're talking about this process, but underwriting the coverage and paying for the treatment of various patients. One of them, an emergency physician I dealt with, said that his favorite time to practice medicine was Christmas. That is to say, Christmas Eve through the couple of days following that holiday, because for the most part, the people who worked on behalf of the managed care companies, the bureaucrats who would restrict his options in terms of what they were willing to pay for, are off the clock, and so because he doesn't have them looking over his shoulder, as he said, he can actually practice medicine. And the only time he can practice medicine is when the bureaucrats are off doing something else.
Well, you know, I think one of the big problems is that we focus on all the new patients coming in, but this is really, in many respects, is about Medicare. And what are they talking about, Medicare? They're talking about another 20% reduction in what they pay the doctors. Well, they've already cut the doctors two or three times, and you cut them another 20%. And it's going to happen sooner or later. And doctors are just going to quit taking either new Medicare patients, or they're simply going to quit Medicare altogether.
Mm-hmm.
This is what it's really about. You know, it's really all about how are we going to cut back on Medicare expenditures. We can't tell the American people this is all about cutting back care for granny. We've just got to say, oh, no, this is about, you know, everybody's going to have a medical care. No, it's about rationing health care to the elderly, those over 65. And it's all about death panels. It's all about end-of-life counseling. And till we address that fact, it's all about rationing to the elderly and redoing Medicare. Nothing makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Go right ahead, William.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Well, many men begin having prostate symptoms when they get to be 60 years of age, so Radio Liberty is offering a great product. It's called Prostate Support. It's put together by one of the country's leading health food manufacturers. It contains ingredients which have been proven to work. I know health experts who take the product, and I use it as well, and I think that really is very effective. In addition, we have a product for women during that difficult time of life. It's called Menopause Support. And lastly, we have a product for people who have chronic difficulty with their immune system and nothing else seems to work. It's called Immune Support. All are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. These products are compiled by a very reliable company. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
You have to stay with the National Health Service, and they will get around to treating you if they have time. And on any elective procedure, they very seldom have time. If you get to be older, they are going to do everything they can to avoid treating you. But if you have sufficient money, and certainly William's talking about an interview with a very wealthy person from Great Britain, and in Great Britain, they have a two-tiered health service, one for those who can pay and one for you common people who are just simply useless eaters. So go right ahead with the system, because yes, that eventually is what is planned for the United States. They are not going to tell you the plan. I was told this plan almost 30 years ago by a man from the Reagan administration who said, we're going to end up with a two-tiered system in America. Well, that's what they have in Great Britain. So why don't you explain about that?
That's exactly right. One of the things we keep hearing is that we need to end our two-tiered system, but the two-tiered system here as is the case in Great Britain, is an artifact of political intervention. It was in the Nixon administration that you had the template created for these HMOs, what the American Medical Association 60 or 70 years ago called medical Soviets, which, of course, are these managed care monstrosities that are the result of the tax and regulatory policies imposed on the medical profession during the Nixon administration. And Nixon actually tried to create a full-blown socialized medicine system in January 1974, and he was actually not impeached, but he was chased out of office by the threat of impeachment before that threat could be consummated. And so, ironically enough, we have the Democrats in the Nixon administration to thank for forestalling the advent of what we're dealing with now in the form of Obamacare. But what this British actor Jude Law was talking about is the fact that in the National Health Service, as it's called over in Great Britain, you have these very gifted and conscientious doctors who absolutely hate the system that they're forced to work in, because they're forced to work exceptionally long hours for very low compensation. It's not cost-effective, and of course, that's something to take in consideration given the expense and commitment that goes to making a medical career. I'm astonished at the amount of time and effort and trouble and the burden that is imposed on people to go into that field, and they usually go into it because they feel a sense of vocation. There's something that God has put in their souls that makes them gravitate toward the healing arts. It's something much more important to them than the financial rewards or the social status that comes from being a doctor. I mean, I honestly think that it's a form of religious vocation for many people. And so you have these huge commitments of time and effort and industry and money, and then they end up in the system where they work obscenely long hours for scandalously low pay. They hate the system, but the system exists, and they end up working for it in ways that compromise their ability to carry out their Hippocratic responsibilities. But if you happen to be a Jude Law, a multimillionaire British actor who is one of People magazine's sexiest men alive, and who can think nothing about getting on a jet and flying across the Atlantic and actually getting health care in the United States when it's not available through the National Service in Great Britain, it's perfectly fine. You might be able to find somebody in Great Britain who's able to perform that treatment for you and might be able to circumnavigate the bureaucratic impedimenta in order to do it. But when we're talking about national health care in Great Britain, this two-tier system, one story that I read and commented about in one of my Liberty Minute commentaries a couple of weeks ago is perfectly typical of this. You had a poor kid, a 22-year-old former football standout, who contracted brain cancer, and he ended up in the hospital. And his nurses in the National Health Service were inattentive in administering one of the medicines he was receiving, and he ended up being severely dehydrated. And he kept begging for water, but none of the nurses would respond to his complaints. He ended up calling the police and asking for them to intervene because he was suffering from critical dehydration. His mother noticed what was going on, and she complained, but none of the administrators would listen to her. The police showed up because this man was about to die from dehydration, and the nurses and the attendants there said, well, you need to ignore him because he's under a physician's care, and he's receiving the care that he needs. And they showed that they'd filled out all the appropriate bureaucratic documentation. And within a day, this kid was dead from renal failure. He managed to survive brain cancer, but the National Health Service killed him. And the kicker to the story is that the mother, who saw her 22-year-old son die a perfectly avoidable death, I mean, this has to be considered a murder through culpable negligence and malign indifference. The mother received no sympathy at all from the administrators of this hospital. No treatment or counseling for her bereavement. But the administrators and the nursing personnel, the NHS nursing personnel, who had collaborated to kill this kid, were given bereavement leave and counseling by the National Health Service, and they were the ones who killed the kid. Now that, in microcosm, is an illustration of the type of situation, the type of system that they have in Great Britain that really represents the type of system that's going to be inflicted upon us very quickly, because Obama.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back. From the mountains. Well, William, you picked the story up from there.
Yeah, I was talking about this poor young man from Great Britain who was basically murdered by the National Health System while he was undergoing treatment for a brain tumor. He was dehydrated, critically dehydrated, despite repeated emphatic pleas to be allowed to drink something, and despite calling the police to assist him as he was sitting there dying in his bed, he was allowed to die through dehydration, and his mother was not permitted to help him out. And as a result, you ended up with a situation where she saw her son, her 22-year-old son, die. And she wasn't given any kind of institutional apology or even extended the opportunity for bereavement counseling by the NHS. But the doc, well, not the doctors. The doctors weren't involved in this decision. It was the nursing personnel and the administrators who were responsible for killing that kid. They were given bereavement counseling and I guess, bereavement leave by the NHS. And I was saying that this perfectly illustrates the perverse priorities of the system of Great Britain. And that's the system we're going to end up with ere long, because the Obamacare system, this corporatist, which is to say corporate socialist or fascist medical system that's being imposed upon us, they're working with the delivery of benefits here. They're not talking about improving the actual practice of medicine or materially improving the type of treatment we'd receive. They're talking about controlling how it's paid for and how it will be allocated. That's going to lead us ineluctably in the direction of a single-payer program like the one they have in Great Britain. And that's something Mr. Obama has admitted. That's something that many of the people promoting this have admitted. This is an incremental step in the direction. It's not merely a step. This is a considerable march in the direction of single-payer, because you've got a system that is fiscally unworkable and materially headed for collapse, and I think they want it to collapse into an outright, unitary, undisguised, monolithic single-payer program where every decision made in the healthcare realm is going to have to be done according to the dictates of the central government. And there are people who oppose...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, William is just talking about we're heading towards a single-payer program where they're going to be rationing access to health care. It's going to take a while to get there, but this whole thing is designed... what they've taken is the first incremental step, but what they really want and what nobody wants to talk about is there really are people who believe in population control, who think there are too many people in the world. Certainly, the... President's chief of staff's brother, his name is Dr. Zeke Emanuel, hates the Hippocratic Oath. He's written publicly about how terrible the Hippocratic Oath is because the doctor is concerned about his patient rather than what's best for society. And, of course, what's best for society is really we've got too many people in the world, and especially too many old people. And he's written extensively about this. He belongs to organizations that support Dr. Kevorkian's a great work of helping people out of their misery, or maybe they're not even miserable. He just helps them to go on to the next life. Well, William, before we go on, I'd like you to get out your website, your blog site, tell people how they can hear your radio program, and how they can get to your PayPal button.
I sure appreciate that, Dr. Stan. My blog and my radio program are both called Pro Libertate. The blog is found at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And Freedom in Our Time, once again, is one of these run-on compound words that are so commonplace on the Internet. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I update it between 3 and 5 times a week. I just updated it this evening, as a matter of fact, with an essay entitled Resistance that talks about the little appreciated but indispensable common law right to resist unlawful government aggression. I mean, that's what the Second Amendment's all about, basically. I mean, if we don't have that right, the Second Amendment makes no sense. And if the Second Amendment reads or says what it obviously says, if it means what it says, then that right obviously is at the forefront. It's one of the tentpoles of liberty, and I talk a little bit about some of the applications of that right in this essay at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. As you pointed out, Dr. Stan, at the end of every essay, there is a place where people can go donate money if they have the means and the inclination. I do have a PayPal account, and a number of people in your listening audience have very generously donated, and I really appreciate that. They've been very kind. I've received some donations in the mail as well, and literally that's what's keeping my family afloat right now. I am, as I've said before, like the proverbial street musician who plays for tips. I'm the troubadour on the street corner with an empty guitar case who's crooning to a public, hoping that somebody will see fit to bestow some remuneration for my efforts. So once again, anybody who has access to the internet and can use a PayPal account to make a donation, I really appreciate the help that we've received, and God bless you for it. My radio show is also called Pro Libertate, and it's broadcast on the Liberty News Radio Network every weeknight from 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock Mountain Time. That's 5 to 6 in California, or 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock Central Time. That's libertynewsradio.com. If you go to the Liberty News Radio website, you can find a list of affiliates. The network does have, I believe by now, several dozen conventional terrestrial radio affiliates, and we're available by way of open broadcast in a number of places in California, and I believe in Oregon as well, Washington, Texas, Utah. I believe we have affiliates in the South and in the Midwest. And by way of the Internet, of course, we can be heard anytime by anybody. The archives of my program and every installment of the programs offered by the other guests are available at libertynewsradio.com. And by way of iTunes, people can receive podcasts of all the programs as well. There are a number of people who subscribe by way of iTunes and listed these as podcasts. I get interesting email from people who listen to my program as a podcast on by way of portable MP3 player. The list of me was they're driving. And, of course, they do that with the other many of the other guests or other hosts as well. So it's libertynewsradio.com for the Pro Libertate radio program. You can listen to it live or listen to the archives or get the shows by podcast, and freedominourtime.blogspot.com to read the essays.
All right, fine. Well, let's go on with your discussion.
Well, we were talking earlier about what's going on with respect to rationing of health care and the management of the demographics, which is to say people control, population control. And it's been more or less an inevitability as the population ages and as the economy sickens that we'd reach a point where people would be seduced into a government-controlled system of health care delivery. And that, of course, will create a dynamic towards contracting the available amount of health care. I mentioned in an earlier segment the fact that an authoritative survey of physicians indicates that we could see anywhere from 15 to 30% or more of practicing physicians leave that field because of what the government takeover of healthcare is likely to mean for their livelihoods. This is a time when we need at least a 20% expansion in the number of doctors. So whether or not the money is there, and the money's not going to be there long, obviously, given what's going on with the economy, given what's going on with the mounting deficits and the forthcoming interest rate spikes that are going to be just hugely unsettling and catastrophic in many, many ways. It's not just going to be the money that's not there, it's going to be the doctors who aren't there, unless the government's going to get into the practice of requiring people to stay in that profession, irrespective of the economic consequence. I could actually see that sort of thing happening. But a more likely outcome is that you're going to have a greater emphasis on what you have correctly identified, Dr. Stan, as the end-of-life discussion. Hillary Clinton, 15 or 16 years ago, made a point, and this is why Hillary Care, unlike Obamacare, didn't make it through. Hillary Care is nowhere, or Hillary rather, Hillary Clinton, is an off-putting, somewhat frigid personality. Barack Obama tends to be more anodyne. There's a certain facile uplift in the way that he pronounces things. He tends to be a better salesman than Hillary Clinton because Hillary Clinton has this ascetic clinical air about her that makes her less effective as a spokesman or a spokeswoman in her case for the idea of government seizure of the medical system. Whereas, you know, Barack Obama tends to speak in the cadences of somebody who seems to be perhaps more authentic or at least more compassionate. But the problem is, it's the same dynamic, the same mechanism that Clinton's healthcare program would have been back in the early 1990s. One of the first things she said, and this illustrates both her arrogance and her incurable tin ear for politics, one of the first things she said is, we're going to be talking with people about filling out advance directives and other end-of-life provisions as part of the healthcare reform process. Well, why are you doing this? Well, obviously it's because you've got to talk about rationing care for those who do not happen to fit the proper criteria in terms of life expectancy and what they call quality of life. And that brings us to the nasty business of QALYs. Quality Adjusted Life Year is what that acronym stands for. A quality adjusted life year is an actuarial metric that is used to measure, by way of a percentage or a rating, the suitability of a recipient for government rationed health care. One of the things that will inevitably happen is that the people who are in charge of acting as gatekeepers for health care decisions are going to be using QALYs, whether they're disguised as some other, by some other acronym or by some other name, I don't know, but they will make some kind of a measurement based on the anticipated lifespan and the anticipated expense of a given medical treatment, and then they're going to have to use some other criterion having to do with the social worthiness of a given recipient in order to assess whether or not, or to what extent, such an individual is going to receive health care. And this reflects something that Ezekiel Emanuel has said, and you mentioned this just in the very end of the last segment, Dr. Stan, with respect to the so-called social responsibility of physicians. Historically, physicians have been very individualistic. They've been very compassionate. They've been very generous. They've had an eleemosynary inclination toward other people, but that's not at all incompatible with rugged individualism. Rugged individuals can be as compassionate as anybody. As a matter of fact, I believe that only a genuine individual can be truly compassionate, because the individualist in the Christian sense is going to act on the basis of the golden rule. That which you would have done to you, you will do unto others. Well, in the case of physicians, I honestly believe that you couple the best impulses of the altruist with the best impulses of the individualist. There are many people who don't really understand this, and historically physicians have been among the least enthusiastic when it comes to embracing the tenets of collectivism, and they've been among the first to resist collectivism because they swear an oath in the Western tradition. You know, of course, this is something which is almost universal now, owing to the influence of the West in propagating this ethic. But owing to the Hippocratic ethic, in which the responsibility is to do what is best for the patient, the doctors tend to be individualistic, not only in terms of the way they conduct themselves professionally, but also in terms of how they approach the duties of their profession. Now, in the social welfare tradition, in the Marxist tradition, whether you're talking about the hard Marxist left that coalesced around Lenin, or whether you're talking about the Fabian socialist tradition that began in 1889 and that took shape in Western Europe and in England in particular, and in elements of the United States, there is a different ethic with respect to health care, and it's entirely collectivist. The social welfare states of Europe, particularly the continental ones, starting with Bismarck's social insurance state, emphasize the idea that the physician has to be a social servant who is primarily concerned with treating the body politic as a whole, treating the collective, and that his duties toward a given individual patient are subordinated to his larger duties to society as the state defines that entity, and the state defines the best interests of that entity. So he's supposed to be a government functionary before he's an actual practitioner of Hippocratic medicine. In the early decades of the 20th century, there was a really robust discussion of this in Wilhelmine, Germany, as the social insurance state dictated that the government was going to be more active in the business of allocating medical treatment. And by the time Adolf Hitler came to power, there was actually an established understanding on the part of the collectivized and state-run elements of German healthcare system. It, of course, there were many fine and decent and conscientious physicians who resisted this, but there was a critical plurality, if not majority, of healthcare professionals who succumbed to collectivism. But there was an established understanding that it was the duty of the doctor to act on behalf of what the state called society and not on the best interest of the patient. So it doesn't surprise me at all to learn that very little resistance ensued when the National Socialist government retrofitted into this existing collectivist healthcare system an ethic in which so-called useless eaters would be euthanized or otherwise quietly disposed of. Robert J. Lifton's book, The Nazi Doctors, gets into this, as does another book by an author named Wortham, I can't remember his first name, called The Mark of Cain. They both talk about the way that the role of the physician was changed. That's what we're going to have now. We're going to have fewer and fewer of the conscientious, individualist, physician, patient-oriented medical professionals, and we're going to have people being brought into the system who will be told that their social obligations transcend their obligations to any individual patient, just at a time when the demographics of the aging baby boom cohort collide with the downward trend in terms of the available financial resources. And you add these together, and any way you run the math, it comes out euthanasia. And so whether you're talking about passive euthanasia, whether you're talking about active euthanasia, I don't know if we're talking about a general application of Kevorkian-style ethics, but you can starve somebody to death. You can dehydrate somebody. As I mentioned, the case of what happened in the National Health Service in Great Britain, that's an example of actual active euthanasia by way of dehydration. We had a case of that sort in Florida not too terribly long ago. This is the sort of thing that's going to become, I'm afraid, systemic in healthcare here in the United States. And it's not going to take very long, owing to the disruptions that are about to occur this year, most likely after August, when September, October rolls around this year. We're going to have another wave, I firmly believe, of financial dislocations that are going to make what happened in 2008 look relatively mild and inconsequential by comparison. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, Social Security is already financially an invalid. This wasn't supposed to happen for 6 years, and it's only going to get worse. And on top of everything else, the government ruling us right now, not happy to be spending us into absolute penury in order to bail out Wall Street and now to take over the healthcare system, is talking about yet another round of wars. And there are things going on right now in terms of prepositioning and movement of men and materiel that suggest that very quickly we're going to have some kind of nastiness either here at home or abroad that will involve another major military commitment. When I was on my way to New Hampshire, I made an abortive effort to get to New Hampshire last week to attend a conference that I couldn't get to because my children were sick, and that dictated that we return here to Idaho. I, like several other people I've talked to, noticed that there is a very active movement of military personnel and military vehicles heading west from the Midwest. We saw an entire convoy of armored personnel carriers on I-80 heading west, and they were flanked on either side by military helicopters, and that was just one of several instances where we saw a major movement of military hardware. And I get back, and suddenly my inbox is filled with photographs of people who have taken to places like Washington, of row after row, boxcar after boxcar, of APCs and other vehicles of that sort being transported, apparently through Oregon down to California or somewhere. That's the sort of thing that makes me suspect that there's some big military operation in the offing in the immediate term. I don't know whether we're talking about an outright domestic application of the imperial mandate from Washington or whether we're talking about prepositioning these assets for action in some Asian or Middle Eastern theater. I don't know whether we're talking about the possibility of something happening at the border, the southern border of the United States, but there are a number of auguries in the wind right now that we're going to see yet another expansion of the permanent warfare state, and of course that consumes wealth like very few other things can. So you combine the activities of the welfare state and the warfare state, it ends up adding up to bankruptcy, And that means that people who are going to be forced into this medical system are going to be put down. And I don't like that prospect.
I don't either, Chris. My fear is that we're moving into a war with Iran. This whole thing is simply all being orchestrated. And, well, we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up the program this evening. Our guest has been William Grieg. I hope you've enjoyed his analysis. It is right on. William, go right ahead. You got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Dr. Stan, once again, I want to thank you for the opportunity of being on your program. I have...
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about any unexpected crisis. Freeze-dried guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze-dry guy, the best you can buy.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com. 1-800-SPECIAL.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Power Hour Radio Show. It is 30 July 2010. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for caring about your world. This is Joyce Riley.
And Josh.
And Josh. That's right. He's back again today. He's making a visit to the Power Hour, and we are so pleased to have him join us today. A lot of you wondered, where did he go? Where did he go? Well, he did exactly what he said he was going to do. He's going to build a house.
I'm knee-deep in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm building a house right
in
now.
This 112-degree heat out
yes.
there.
It's been a little hot.
You are all red and tan and... Yeah, looks like you've been doing it.
My daughter said something about me being red yesterday. She mm-hmm. she thought that because I've been eating so many cantaloupes that the cantaloupes were making me turn red.
Cantaloupes make yeah. you turn red. You know, I mean, if she was real bright, she might say that tomatoes might be turning yeah. you red. But that's Whatever. Well, anyway, we're glad to have you here today, and we're going to be talking about the news that really is the news, not the news that you would be watching on television. You know, if you're watching television, you're hearing about Chelsea's big, fat, secret wedding. That's a big issue right now. How much money are they spending? Well, it's going to be in the millions, and I think it's important because it shows what the elite do. Money is no object to them because they take it from us and use it for them. You know, Josh, I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but last year, Obama made about $7 to $8 million in office.
Doing what?
Well, that was my question, because he makes what, $150,000 a year, $200,000 a year? That's what his salary is.
Yeah.
My question is, does he have a second job?
I don't know how it works. I wish I could get paid to play golf.
Well, I want to know, how does a man make $7 million in 1 year when he's got a job running this country? That's what I want to know.
I have no idea.
And being on The View and stuff like that, which that's another issue I'd like to talk about.
White House concerts.
White House concerts. Yeah, no kidding. Anyway, we need to talk about the Michigan oil spill. That's major. And I want to thank Bev from Michigan for giving me the information on that. She says it's a lot worse than anyone's talking about, and it looks like it may go even further than it is in the lake right now. Into Kalamazoo is affected by this. We'll talk about that. Also, the death benefit issue, we didn't quite get to that yesterday, but this death benefit issue of the Pentagon, did you know that the Pentagon makes money off of sons and daughters that get killed in Iraq and Afghanistan? Yeah, it's a real nice little sweet deal they have. Cool one. We've got... Oh, no, I'm not even going to tell you right now. It's going to be a surprise because this is so bad. So bad. What happened? I'm not even going to say it. And another really bad story. Arlington Graves got mixed up. You know where people go to be buried? Their very last wish is to be buried at Arlington. And you want to go visit your family member there and be able to know that that's where they are? Well, guess what? Not a good situation for about, are you ready for this, 6,600 graves. Cannot believe this could actually be happening. What are they thinking? What are they doing? It seems that the president has more time to go on The View and do the kinds of entertainment issues that give him such joy. When people are out losing jobs, we haven't even heard about the oil spill lately, have we? It's almost as if oil spill?
Yeah, what oil spill?
Didn't they get that fixed? Yeah, that must be all done and over with, isn't it?
Oh, I'm sure. Just ask the people in the Gulf.
Yeah, they can't find the oil. How many times have you seen stories, where's the oil, where's the oil? Well, Corexit took care of it, and it destroyed the oil so that it cannot be examined forensically, and they